So, you know, often the people practicing Dhamma seek awakening, enlightenment, wisdom, clarity, knowing. And this is, one way of looking at it. But the cessation of suffering takes us to the feeling quality of it. You could speculate about awakening and how awake you are, or half awake, or never going to wake up, or deluded, or think you're awakened. So often people who think they're awakened are generally a little bit loopy, you know, kind of going off. But you can know whether you're suffering or not, know whether there's stress or not, and this is much more, accurate. And also knowing where the ease and the happiness is. So, you know, the Buddha, like many other aspirants, started off on a kind of ideological search. You know, what's the end? What's the meaning of life? Where's the deathless? And you know, kinds of things that were kind of the menu to how to get there was in that time through basically repressing the body and then getting your mind to go out of your body into some deathless state. You know, this is going to die, right? So deathless must be get out of this and go there, somewhere out there, and get out of this thing there. Because this is dying, so, yeah, makes sense, doesn't it? So how do you get out of this thing? Well, we'll forget about it, neglect it. We don't care about it anymore, neglect the thing. And try to develop a kind of mind that will crush any kind of physical feeling, particularly pleasant feeling, because that could, you know, really get you back involved in all this stuff. So this is kind of this instinct, and it's actually quite common. You know, across all spiritual traditions, the ascetic self-flagellation and self-mortification. And the Buddha, so he did this to the sort of excellence, and until he was kind of falling over, he was so skinny and emaciated and ragged and he couldn't even stand up anymore, he was kind of so wrecked. And then this beautiful, you know, this turning is expressed in different ways. You know, one is a lovely image of this young girl Sujata who brings him some milk rice. You know, so this sense of the human, very simple human metta. You know, the most basic, I feed you. You know, I offer to you this gesture, not just the rice itself, but the gesture. And you're taking this and just kind of reflect on that, the beauty of just that, that we can do, the connection to, you know, you're another being and some sympathy there, an offering. So taking, this is one way it's described and legendary. And then sitting and making enough, just enough to come back to some reasonable state of health. And then just recognizing this is just painful, and then the recognition of when he was a little boy sitting under a tree in the shade, where it's very hot and it's in the shade, cool, pleasant, sheltered, safe, comfortable, and feeling kind of at ease. That felt peaceful. And he'd bring his mind back to that and just be in that state of mind, then he can feel his breathing, entering back into that, and then he's feeling the breathing. Maybe this is it. This kind of pleasure is not a problem. It's actually helps my mind to settle. You know? So coming into the body through this way, and even in that short anecdote, you know, you can sense the first thing is the gift. Even this great, amazing being, the Buddha, you know, well, before he was Buddha, incredible resolve, diligence, determination, you know, all massive qualities, and yet the turning point is the given, you know, the gift. Something like that, and then also the recollection, not of some noble idea or divine revelation, just of being a little boy. And that's beautiful, the kind of human, earthy simplicity of it, the lightness, and there's a kind of young quality to it. It's not serious, it's not intellectual, it's just a simple human warmth and comfort, and feeling that, and then using that as a basis for feeling what, when you're in that mode, natural quality of breathing in and out, the mind goes to that, settles into it, and then beginning to refine itself, dropping away other concerns, fears, agitations, craving, proliferation, fantasies, malice, and then purity, purifying the mind through this pleasure, subtle pleasure. So that's the epitome of the Buddhist transmission. So pleasure as a path to enlightenment. That's a particular kind, isn't it? Where there's it's sensitive. It's the pleasure of sensitivity. It's the pleasure of feeling safe and held. It's the pleasure of kind of like a present attention into a natural process, which is already given. And breathing in and breathing out. So he's not trying to make it something, get somewhere, work out the meaning of life, resolve his issues with his dad, or whatever. But just that pleasure. And using that to purify the negative influences of the mind. So he always said, I teach pleasure. Which was quite mind-blowing in that day and age. You know, people thought you'd gone really slack and corrupted. It's the recognition, the mind settles in this pleasure. It's comforted. Because it's comforted, it doesn't crave. It loses its fear. It loses its guilt, its regret. It loses that. What's that supposed to? It's supposed to be pleasant. To stop suffering is supposed to be kind of nice. and the phrase Nibbana Paramang Sukham. Nibbana is the supreme, the highest, the most worthwhile form of pleasure, ease. You can translate it as ease. That's the removal of disease, so the mind is just light. And that's one way of kind of trying to get a feel for it, not just the idea of awakening, the feel of it. Because this strand, this theme, runs through all true cultivation. Admittedly, you know, we may have to definitely meet disagreeable and meet the craving and the fear and the guilt and the worry and all that. And we may meet it and it's not particularly pleasant, but the theme is as one releases that, there's the quality of pleasure. And that pleasure is something to abide in, to dwell in, to make much of. The word is absorb. So absorb, and this is where the word jhana comes from. So, you know, jhana being an absorbed state. And as one absorbs, the mind becomes unified. Samadhi. And it's said then there's not one part of one's body that is not saturated, permeated, suffused with pleasure. Pleasure born of skillful states. Pleasure born of ease and spaciousness. Mind releasing. And they said, this is actually, in the suttas, considered, this is not, is it considered essential to experience this quality of light, but suffusive ease, so the hardness and the rigidity and the tension of the mind softens, and then it can, the true, you know, truer qualities can be experienced. So we look for that, and to make much of it, what is it, as it arises, wherever it arises. It's a theme that runs through, you know, whereas we may even, you know, like, it said that, you know, the lovely sutta where the Buddha mentions, if you know, if your body is relaxed and at ease, you will feel happy, pleasant, and there's no particular need to push the mind into concentration, because the mind that receives and sits in that happiness is concentrated, it's collected. And it gives us another way of understanding what samadhi means. It's good to redress some of these terms, because we're using a translation of a Pali, which in the Pali words themselves are verbalizations of an experience, right? So you're going through into the verbal and then even crossing the culture. So concentration for most of us means something that happens in your head, because when you concentrate on your work, that's what you do. When you concentrate on playing a game of chess, that's what you do. You kind of get it up here, and your brow slightly tightens up, and your eyes sharpen, and you're concentrated on what you're doing. And you get annoyed if somebody disturbs you. And so, you know, when you cultivate samadhi, you can have the same thing. You're trying to concentrate on the breath. And then, just nearly then, somebody closed the door. Oh, God, close the door. And I'm nearly there again, and somebody shuffled a cushion. All right, go for a cushion. That stupid people. You know, it feels kind of violent. Stupid people. No mindfulness at all in this place. Can't practice here. Because of people. Stupid, clumsy, ignorant, heedless people. Not like me. You know, this kind of thing can occur. Or you, and you feel, oh dear, ill will, it's not right, is it? And so then the whole thing kind of crashes down. But actually the more fruitful result is to, you know, to feel happy with other people. To feel kind and compassionate for other people, and to feel befriended other people, then they make a bit of noise. It's okay. It's what bodies do. You know? They kind of, it's kind of sweet, really. Because it, you get the sense, you know, when you come down to that feeling level, and one of the most important skills is the skill of opening the heart. You know, and then, you know, you begin to experience the connection, because when the heart opens towards anything, there's a kind of energetic connection, a sense of resonance with it. So you hear somebody coming, somebody come to practice. Beautiful. You know, somebody's coming into practice. Oh, beautiful. Rather than somebody bothering me. You know, you just widen to include the realm that you're in, rather than trying to shut it all off. And you may think, well, I'm never going to get concentrated that way because my mind will keep skipping around. No, the idea isn't you don't focus on this person, that person, this person, what she's doing, and you focus on the sense of aware human beings, sounds, people settling, people practicing, people being where they are. Nobody's bothering me. You know, why should I bother? Why should I make a problem out of this? The really be well. Yeah? That's all we need to know this time. And actually the sense of the happiness and the ease of that, your mind begins to settle, and then that becomes your place of concentration, your place where the mind unifies. Now if you're always fighting against things, then your mind doesn't unify, because it's creating a self and other, self, other, self and the other things that are getting in the way of my wishes. So self, other, that division, that is suffering. Because we have that exclusion experience that I mentioned. You've excluded others, they're other. So that exclusion experience is always marked by a sense of stress. Got to keep them out. Don't want them here. Leave me alone, I'm in my space. Okay, you stay over there, that's fine, but don't get any closer. And then that's stressful. You can't really relax. And sometimes, unfortunately, it's like that. But you know, on a retreat, making a group retreat, making a practice out of just softening those boundaries of nervousness and self-consciousness, and just making a practice out of that. I'd just like to feel comfortable sitting here with other people who are keeping precepts and, you know, not going to do me in, you know, rip me off. I think, well, wonderful. How wonderful to be where there's a situation where everybody's making commitments and working with their stuff. Beautiful. You know, it's so you can also recollect that. It's skillful. Now, you know, in this quality of seeking or understanding the way to pleasure, to turn situations to pleasure, to this subtle pleasure, which is the pleasure of the release of stress and suffering. Yeah. The release of those boundaries of excluding. So you just kind of reflect on it a little bit. Now, conventionally speaking, we have the Buddhist path, you have sila, ethics, virtue, morality. And again, we can make this into a head thing. You know, what would you do if ants infested your house? Would you kill them? Ooh, bad. Wrong. Evil. Bad karma. What would you do if a snake wrapped itself around your mother? Would you say nice words to the snake? Would you tell your mother about the brief brevity of life and encourage her to practice? What would you do? You think, oh God, my moral dilemma. So we can, when we get into ethics, we can concoct these incredible scenarios that would never happen. My mother never got threatened by a snake. You know. So, but we can concoct these moral dilemmas of what we should do to get it right. To get it absolutely right, because otherwise, you know, make those moral errors, you know, they count, they add up, and damnation awaits. So this kind of, I don't know, it's a Christian thing that we inherit, some real, you know, trying to get the morality like a absolutely legal court of law to prove you are right, you know, not wrong. And you get these kind of hair-splitting things. But the sense of sila is really based upon to others as to myself. Yeah. And, you know, treasuring others, treasuring oneself, treasuring the presence of others, their you know, the subjectivity. She too wants happiness, doesn't want unhappiness. She too makes mistakes like me. She too has sorrow like I do. This little creature here doesn't want to die any more than I do. Why should I kill it? You know, recognizing things as subjective rather than objects of my, I don't like the look of you, pap. You know, it's just an object to my gaze or object to my mind. It's trying to get, you know, that too is a subject. itself. So then we sense of honouring and treasuring things, and then, you know, that just getting that and feeling that, oh, that feels beautiful, that feels sweet. Yeah, I feel good when it's like that. I feel bright. And with that, there is a happiness. The connection of subjectivity, coming into true subjectivity, is pleasant. Yeah. Not full subject. The full subjectivity is the I am, I always, I was, I will be. People think this is me, I didn't do that right. The I am is the false subjectivity. It's a creation. There's a true subjectivity, the presence, call it citta, awareness, presence, the sense of I, that intimate sensitivity. Right? This has got a vibrant quality to it, and when you begin to sense that in others, you get that connection. The subjectivities sense each other, you sense the subjectivity in another. That's the quality of love, primal sympathy. And that feels good. You feel it's an agreeable experience. Because the lessening of that stress of who's better, who's worse, who's got it right, how am I, what does he think of me, I've got one over him, he's not as good as I am, that kind of stuff, all that agitation. So we kind of get past the I ams that we can carry and invest so much importance in, down to this just fellow sentient being. And then, that's agreeable, and then your mind settles, and you kind of realign to that. So when your heart, you come to that heart settling state, then you see all these kind of things that are this way and that way and this way and that way. You're not going to make a big deal out of that. That's just conditioned like that, Some are dirty or don't smell the way they should in this way. You can't tidy up the world. It's not going to happen, is it? But so with that, you don't need to tidy it all up, because you have that subjectivity. You can let the forms, the mental forms, the physical forms of people be what they are, and your own be what it is, because you have that quality within that, the subjectivity and a quality of love, sympathy, respect, then you feel good. Your mind isn't agitating. This is one way of looking at the principle of sila. So sila, virtue, morality, heavy word, is really the kind of flip side of the Brahma-vihara. They're both based on mutuality. So sila generally deals with the protocols and how we navigate the separateness with each other. So it's a respect and may I do this, and you're okay, and is it okay to come in, and would you like that? We can negotiating through that, but that's one side of it. That's how you deal with the external form of this, and the internal quality is the quality of primal sympathy, anukampa, empathy, from which these measureless states, metta, karuna, mudita, upeka, kindness, loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, being gladdened by the good, and equanimity, being serene and open to the changes of things without getting hooked in it. You allow a person to go through their stuff, and you maintain presence. You don't give up on them, and you don't necessarily condone their actions, but you don't give up on it. This is on them. This is equanimity. So these qualities, and so the Buddha is saying, this is the happiness of the trained citta, when we've aligned our citta properly, you will be happy. And it's a happiness that's actually greater because you don't need that much and it's portable. You know, so it's more secure because it's coming straight from the heart. It's coming straight from where you are. You don't have to kind of, well, buy one of these and sort that out, come out with this, and it'll make her happy by doing this or buying this for her. She'll be happy because she'll like me. And you know, just straight. This is what we like. This quality. And so that sila. And sila is about really, you know, a true. It's also aligned with truth. And truth is also a source of happiness. Yeah. Truth isn't just about accuracy, it means true resonance. This is how it feels now. This is how it is now. I'm not saying it's like this forever, it's like this now. And anyone you can say that to who says, okay, then you feel connection, you feel happy. This is a friend. So, you know, it feels like this now. It feels horrible, feels awful. And they put it out, and the other person says, yeah, okay, I can receive that, and how's that? With a sense of, that's compassion, isn't it? And then we feel the sense of connection. And even though in some ways, you know, we might feel difficult, awkward, unpleasant, but then there's that pleasure, that subtle ease of having been heard, you might say, in our colloquial language. And then from that, you can settle. You know, my disappointment, my frustration with you, you've received that. Okay, I can, now that tension can dissolve because the boundary has disappeared. We've been straight with each other. And so this quality of you know, sila and connectivity, heart connectivity, is really so precious, because it can, even difficult moods and senses, we can still, if we can find that, then even that, we can find a certain sense of resonance and subtle ease. And same with yourself, you know, when you're really honest about yourself, not just opinionated about yourself, but you know, yeah, that was a mistake. Mm-hmm. Right, good. Because now I know. Now I know you don't do that, do this. So how are you going to know if you can't make a mistake? How else can you get it right if you can't get it wrong? It's like, how do you know? Like, how do you know what balance is except through, that's the imbalance, oh, the balance must be about here. Well, you know, how much do you allow yourself to get things wrong without some recrimination or shrugging it off or justifying it or blaming somebody or blaming yourself? It's okay, that's a mistake. Okay, now, how did that happen? So, you know, all the that we're seeing, this is what brings us to wisdom. So the Buddha is always very clear about this. You know, when someone is able to see an error, a transgression, and acknowledge it as such, he said, oh, this is great. This is great gain. Because now, you know, now your wisdom faculty is a little bit clearer and sharper. So is this great for you? You know, to have seen this, is we consider this progress. Whereas someone who hides their faults or doesn't acknowledge it, denies it, saying, well, there's not much hope for them. You know? And yet how fearful we can be of getting it wrong. And how fearful we can be of each other. Oh my goodness. He might not like this if I. Oh dear, is it okay with monks? What are you supposed to do? Because they might get it wrong. Terrible, be offended, terrible. you know, important person like that, you could make a mistake. And you say, well, look, could you just like treat me like a human being? I feel much more comfortable like that. And that sense of to others as to myself, just base it on that. And, you know, it may be not quite classical perfection, but we can work with that and sort of tidy it up. You know, so this is a sila and kalyanamitta, friendship. And the most important thing, really kind of foundational. Because there's a lot of other people around. And you know, Jean-Paul Sartre, hell is other people, l'enfer c'est les autres. Well, it sort of points out the limitations of existentialism, because that means there's a lot of hell. But true, the otherness is hellish. The sense of otherness is definitely, but other people don't have to be other in that sense. This is the whole sense of kalyanamitta, how we can begin to acknowledge the other quality, the otherness, you know, whatever that feels like, and then sort of work through that. And so someone you can do that with is a spiritual friend. Doesn't mean somebody you really feel great about, all that, but someone who can be open and honest enough to be able to get past the negativities, the projections, the mistakes, the uncertainties, the disappointments, and just hang in there, come through. Yeah. This is. So we make the human realm a place, you see, so much of even our interest in, certainly mine, awakening, get out of this. It's painful, it's messy, it's confusing, it's deceitful, it's get out of this. You know, they're saying like, get out of this body, it's going to die, it has pain in it, get out of it. Not quite. Come to the place within it where that all that afflictive, negative stuff fades out. Then within it, you're out of it. And so the only way out is in. You go into the heart of it. And you see the shadows, the tensions, the possibilities that maybe I'm not, maybe he is, maybe trust the connection, the subjectivity, trust the truth, trust the goodwill. Focus on that. Of course, with other people, there are people, you know, who we find extremely disagreeable, insensitive, deceitful, malicious, and so on. And do not seem to be inclining towards our welfare at all. So what about that? How do you deal with that? This is where, again, you know, you're beginning to recognize, you start with the fortunate. You recollect the fortunate, and you recollect Buddha, and then probably more, in many ways, more useful to recollect teacher, because then you actually have a real human feeling for that sense of that which, you know, whose presence or whose advice painful things of me have dissolved, truth has arisen. I am grateful, I am glad. Yeah. Bearing that in mind, and then you can use that as your basis, then people are disagreeable, unpleasant, jealous, mean, nasty. You come from that place and you think, they too have massive afflictions. They didn't have a teacher. I have compassion for them. Yeah. They didn't have anything to set them straight. They got lost in their delusions. I had a lot of delusions, and I managed to drag myself out of a few. Yeah. So I'm grateful, and I feel a sense of compassion for these beings who are still lost in it. And that's the important cultivation. So when anyone has the real human quality of the connections, the heart connections, and that are based upon skillfulness, where disagreeable states have ceased, one should remember it, bear it in mind, stay with it. This is the absorbing process. You absorb in the quality, the heart quality that's been established. Now you've all done beautiful things. Yeah. And so just even to have kept one precept, you haven't been absolutely perfect and impeccable in every action, which is what we tend to do. Yeah, I've done some good, but then I did that. Because I didn't clean the bathroom very well, or didn't get up in the morning and felt grumpy. No, you didn't kill anybody. And you didn't kill an animal. Feel the quality of the harmlessness, that beauty. So even to get one precept. So you take there where the connection, the virtue, the integrity has been established, and you dwell upon that instead of going to where the faults are and dwelling on them. It's kind of like simple arithmetic. Because wherever you put attention, what you put attention on, that will grow. That will magnify. That we're a dynamic system that accumulates. Put it onto the negative, lo and behold, you'll find many, many things that are wrong with you. Direct it to the... Because the I am itself is a kind of a defended, needy experience. You can't really get a lot of great feeling out of an I am. But you come to the heart of this heart experience, a sense of mutuality and respect and harmlessness, and for one moment dwell upon that, make much of it, that grows. And as it grows and you embody it, as you bring it into your body, you begin to feel certain tensions, edginess, grumpiness begin to cease. So it has a bodily effect. And so it accumulates, and that means that as it accumulates, you've got greater potential for happiness, for ease, and for this quality of release and samadhi. So it's that, it's this step at a time. But every step you select and you tune into the fortunate, the blessed, the happy, in that skillful way, you dwell upon it, make your mind rich with it, and it leads on. That's the process, sila, goes like that. And your mind isn't jumping around because it settles. And if that settling can come, you begin the process of embodiment, which, we've said a few things about, taking that tone, that energy, that settledness, and not just splurging it, like, oh, I had a great day yesterday, but feeling your body within that, the muscles, the tissues, the energies, and inhaling it. So you can embody this quality of ease because it's an energy. An energy crosses between the mental aspect and the physical aspect. That's the embodiment principle. The energy crosses the boundary. And the unification of body and mind is called samadhi. Now, you know, it was always expressed in bodily terms. You know, these jhanas, always expressed in bodily terms. One's body is pervaded with pleasure. One's body experiences bubbling like cool water running into a pond. It's very tangible. Because we're dealing with experiences that have physiological effects. But you need to linger on it to get it to happen. It's not just an idea. To linger on the energetic and the agreeable experience and select, dwell upon it. Kalyanamita, spiritual friend, is considered to be one of the essentials for liberation. You know, there are four essentials for stream entry: to hear the good Dhamma, to practice in accordance with the Dhamma, to cultivate clear, proper attention, and to have a spiritual friend. When you look at that, you realize, well, to hear the good Dhamma, you hear it from a friend, a spiritual friend. To really hear it, rather than read it, to hear it in your ears, in your heart, in your body, you need a spiritual friend. So, to hear the good Dhamma, you need a spiritual friend. And that helps your attention to get your attention to be clear. You want to focus on those qualities that the spiritual friend presents, instructs, even embodies. Pick it up. Then your attention becomes clearer. You see what to see and what to not make an issue out of. What to see and what to not bother yourself with. And then this is practice in accordance with Dhamma, is that process. Give attention to that which causes skillful states to arise. That's practice in accordance with Dhamma. So this all comes down to this same matrix of human connected ease, happiness, energy, respect in that way. Mind, when it absorbs and settles into that, settles down, and this is what is called samadhi, unification. That also is a pleasant experience, agreeable. Yeah. So it's important to acknowledge this, because you know, so often you go, well, if you experience pleasure, don't get attached to it. Careful of pleasure, you might get attached to it. Feel happy, don't get attached to it. Yeah, no, I've been working 6 years to get a moment of happiness, and I've got... It ain't been easy, you know, it's been a struggle. Now it's kind of whipped away from me, like, there it is, but you can't have it anyway. Oh, dear. You know, how heartless can you get? So, because we want the nice wisdom, more important than happiness. But wisdom actually is, the point of wisdom is to discern where stress ceases. So you're wise about where your happiness is. That's wisdom. Wisdom isn't some theoretical thing, abstract concepts. It's about discernment between this is skillful, this is unskillful, this leads to my well-being, this leads to my ruin, this makes me feel good in a skillful way. That's what being wise is. It's not incredibly intellectual experience. You can, but practice is down to acknowledging what's happening in the citta and tuning in to where it feels good. That's called wise. Wisdom makes you happy. Or it allows that to be sensed. So this really is the foundation. And how important it is to discern that. I think I speak for myself, you know, it's coming from my particular culture and conditioning, it's very much, it's a sort of on your own, world is a mess, on your own, sort yourself out, get what you can, do your thing, It's a kind of isolationist experience, conditioning. And then, so when I first, so you don't have a strong relational field, you know, like you notice in the situation in Buddhist India, where people really connected and bonded to each other, family, village, clan, caste, everybody belongs to everything else. Village kids are running around, they belong to everybody. There's that sense in which you're not boxed up in little houses, you know, kids run around and play with other kids and it's all mingling together, you know. And even they take that even to when the teacher takes the disciple, you come and live with me. And so the original foundation of teaching was that the disciple shared the teacher's dwelling. You might have two or three. Get up in the morning, okay, sort things out, get some water together. That's, you know, it's not going to a lecture. You're actually living with this person and give them a foot massage and get their robes ready. You're bonding. And that was considered the proper way to live, you know. To not just to hear the teaching, but also to feel the humanity and to also be able to participate, because you put some effort. You know, you don't see the teacher as some kind of theoretical object, but you support their humanity, and that's considered the proper way. If you see the teacher's that sick, you go and heal him. You don't think, oh well, get another one. So they're not kind of machines, you know. And so you have that sense. And it brings out the best in you. You develop a kind of simple, I too can do a little thing like sweep the floor, you know. It's not, kind of, and that quality of kindness and goodwill and respect is considered to be the appropriate mode to dwell in the teaching situation. So here, you know, with generosity, people offering food, sharing, these kind of things is, you know, that's a simple representation of the model. Yeah. Now, you know, when I, my teachers were my school teachers, who were okay, I guess, you know, but basically, shut up, boy, do this, detention, didn't they get, you know, corrected, you know, you didn't have a human relationship to them, they're information. And I think they were quite reasonable people, actually, they didn't do anything. But you weren't supposed to, you know, do anything more than that. You didn't go to your headmaster and give him a foot massage. So you come to a monastery. I went to the monastery when I turned up at this monastery in Thailand. Okay, you know, monks, serious people, monks, moral, serious moral people. Oh dear, you know. But those, they give you a little cootie to dwell in, and it's quite, you know. And with the Thais, are so kind of mingled that they encourage you to separate a little bit, to be a bit more separate, because they so bond with each other. They kind of like to, even the men like to hold each other's hands and they giggle and, you know, they're really, they say, oh, just cool down a bit. You know? Because you can just kind of play and you can see adults just playing with each other. And so, which you don't do in England. So a sense of just cool it a bit. But if you're already half frozen emotionally, you get into a chiller. So I just feel this extreme isolation and loneliness, because there's nobody, you won't talk to anybody, nobody see you. And then occasionally there's the samaneras would come by and they'd give you some food, but it's, and the nuns would come by, and this kind of, because you're not supposed to, there's not supposed to look at them, look at you. So you feel a bit like nervy. So put down a cloth and something's going to go wrong here. So you get this kind of fear of people. And then I'd lie down on it in the evening and you just have the wood floor and it's a rattan mat. So it's even just not cushion, it's rattan. like reeds, yeah, on a wooden floor, and lie down on this floor. Oh, so hot. You didn't need any blanket. Lie there. You feel something, cockroaches nibbling your feet. They come out at night, they get the hard skin off the feet, they nibble them. Oh, at least somebody loves me. You get to kind of enjoy it. Because there's some sense of some being recognizes me. And they were quite respectful. You know, they weren't. They just take the hard skin. I didn't need it. That's fine. They didn't crawl in my eyes. And okay, to have a bit of foot, that's fine with me. So you've got some sense of a, you know, another sentient being. Why am I feel happy? So it was just a sense of, you know, I think these creatures are getting something. They're creatures, they're alive. They're seeking food, they're looking for things. They're not out to do anything nasty, they just want to get their food. Fine, they can have a bit of my dead skin. No problem, you know. And then you can relax a sense of nasty cockroach, dirty, filthy stuff. They're just the sense of contact nibbling away. Okay. So, you know, you could linger on the idea of, you sit up all night swatting cockroaches. But you realise after a while, you know, it's their territory. You know, we share this earth. So what? And you get to relax that. I mean, so a sense, even with that, you get a sense of the non-violence and non-discrimination. You feel quite, you know, quite happy to just have that relationship. So it's just detecting that thread and understand. So, you know, we said pain isn't necessarily suffering. You can experience pain, but actually, instead of suffering, is exclusion. Exclusing. So when we resist pain, which is natural, then you generate suffering. Is it possible to go against that, you know, physical pain, and start to, it's just what happens to bodies. It's not trying to do anything, not trying to kill me, it's just doing what it does and release. And then, you know, the painful mental stuff. This is a disagreeable mental feeling. If I keep fighting it and resisting it, then this tension and nastiness occurs in my mind. Why don't I just relax, find out where I feel comfortable, stay there. That's my business. That's the business of my citta's health. Don't keep giving attention to this stuff. And it dissolves. Because all the negative mental stuff is created by the mind. The mind isn't creating it, doesn't have to be there. Right? So if the mind does its proper duty, which is to attend to this place of ease, then we're not finding ourselves obsessed with what we did wrong, what other people are, and so on. And that's our process, to acknowledge, but also to return to the goodwill. And if these negative feelings still arise, then you have to include, you have to open and say, okay, she didn't treat me well. I do feel a difficult feeling with her. I could stay with this, or I could say, I have no more issue, I'm not making anything more out of it. Let her be the way she is. You know, she can't take me away from this. This inner quality, my own value and worth. So we practice like this. So, you know. Then other people are, in a way, you know, they are practice. They are the practice whereby we experience a sense of humanity, real humanity, you know, humble, acknowledging everybody's got their stuff, nobody's ideal, real humanity. And in real humanity is the seed of awakening. Then we begin to put aside the blaming and accusing and the jealousy and the fear and the nervousness and the sense of I'm not good enough. And we need to reside in that. And the mind begins to release. And you see, you know, with the other, there's something to learn about where I'm still opinionated, or I'm still defensive, I'm still nervy, I'm still, you know, comparing and contrasting. Something to learn here. Where does that occur? Is she really like that, or do I feel she's like that? What is it in me that, what's in my mind that's saying she's so conceited and up in herself? What does that? Do I need to have any judgment of another person? So it kind of, it also helps to just prioritize the citta of each other's cittas rather than each other's karma, karmic patterns, inheritances. When you, sometimes as I do, when you listen to people's stories, you think, oof, yeah, no wonder she's a bit grumpy. You know, kind of betrayed, beat up, you know. Yeah. No wonder he's a little bit, you know, insensitive when you listen to this, some of the stories. And then compassion. I always like to recall the story of I think Baldin Gyatso, who is a Tibetan monk who spent 30 years imprisonment in Tibet. The Chinese authorities put him in prison because they asked him to denounce his teacher, to say his teacher had been a spy. And he said, well, no, he's not. He's not a spy. So they said, well, they beat him up. Said, you have to denounce your teacher. He said, well, but it wouldn't be true. I can't say what isn't true, because it isn't true. Well, you know, I can't formulate lies. So if you want to know about my teacher, he's this. So they beat him up again. And then he got put in prison and tortured. Escaped, so then he got beat up some more for escaping and, you know, tortured and terrible things. You read the book, you know, they put an electric cattle prod in the mouth so all the teeth get blown out. And, you know, other people were getting starved and people were encouraged to tell light to inform on each other, you know. So yeah, the encouragement was you should try to denounce your fellow cellmates. Otherwise, if you're not denouncing anybody, then you get beaten up. So he got beat up a lot. And he wasn't the only one. Many of them died in those prisons and starving and various things. And eventually, he's been there 30 years. And he said, he was some 60 odd. He said, look, you know, you've been beating me up for 30 odd years. I'm, you know, if you like, you do some more. But I'm an old man, you know, just, your mother let, your mother will let me go home. And I think that they did. And he managed to escape from Tibet and he went to see the Dalai Lama, and he said, he had this question. He said, you know, I've got this kind of worry in my mind because I'm not certain whether at any moment I might have lost my sense of compassion for my prison or my tormentors. you know, I might have slipped away from it, that sense of compassion. Because that's what kept him alive. That's what kept him alive. That is, he didn't let the heart go down. You know? He didn't let it die. Didn't let it feel closed down in hatred and ill will, or defeat and misery. He's kept the heart bright with compassion. And that's what kept him alive. Survive, you know, without going mad or embittered, to come out and even be a sense of concern over whether he'd been compassionate enough. You know, that's pragmatic. It's not just a nice idea, it's what keeps people alive through these miserable situations. And it does. It does. And so, this is to remember this, because you all have that. It's natural. You all have that sympathetic sense. You all have some sense of empathy. You wish to be friendly to each other. You know, you don't quite know how to do it, but you maybe something you just wish. You don't want to feel enemies. Tune into that, even the wish for goodwill. Tune into the sense that when you see, you know, someone else that seems to be, you know, sitting, looking good, sense of, oh, good for her. You know, tune into other people rather than ignore them, shut them out. In this way of Dhamma, then other people are a blessing to you and will make your heart rich and strong. So even, you know, when people part and separate, the nature of our minds is we can retain, we can absorb into what's been given, what's been shown, what's come up in ourselves in the presence of others, in the shared and the shared struggle and practicing together. We can still bear that in mind. We can feel the resonances of that, just as you can feel the resonances of your grief and your hurt. Tune into the resonances of your happiness, your virtue, your friendship, your integrity, and that won't leave you. This is what we can do for each other in this life. So offer this for your reflection.